shall we begin?
The prosecutor's office is doing once again is it's pursuing the modified limited hangout strategy. They will admit what has been documented. They will obfuscate what is still in dispute. They will obstruct, delay, and dissimulate. Eventually, they're going to try to do a deal to preserve some colorable claim that they did something other than frame an innocent man for murder and steal 20 years of his life in the process. The prediction you just heard was one made on this program last September 10th, 7 months, almost to the day, before precisely that kind of plea bargain was offered to Christopher Tapp, who has spent more than 2 decades behind bars for a murder he didn't commit. In the interval, there has been a very important appellate court hearing and ruling. The hearing was in December of last year. That has arranged for 2 hearings which will be convened on April 25th, dealing with 2 separate appeals that have been filed on behalf of Christopher Tapp, both of which will be granted. If Christopher Tapp is willing to remain in prison for roughly another 6 weeks, he will be released as an innocent man. He could face the prospect of a second trial, which is something he has been asking for roughly 16 years, if memory serves. Christopher Tapp was convicted on the basis of a confession that was extracted from him through psychological torture. That is a fact that has now been conceded even by the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, the same prosecutor's office that is trying desperately to get him to plead guilty today. Danny Clark, the chief prosecutor of Bonneville County, is seeking a face-saving plea bargain on the eve of those 2 judicial hearings that will exonerate Chris Tapp if Chris Tapp can just exercise a little bit more forbearance under circumstances that are impossible for most of us to imagine. It's important to recall that no physical evidence or eyewitness testimony connected Christopher Tapp to the scene of the June 1996 murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge. Idaho Falls Police Sergeant Jared Furman, who was the lead investigator, had initially sought to coerce Tapp into implicating a friend, either Ben Hobbs, who had been arrested in Ely, Nevada for rape, or Jeremy Sargis, who for some reason was looked upon as a suspect in this crime for reasons that have never been clearly articulated by anybody. All 3 of these young men were excluded as suspects by DNA evidence that was obtained at the scene. Rather than following that evidence to a plausible suspect, Furman and his comrades at the IFPD simply decided to make do with the suspect that they had. Jeremy Sargis, to his credit, had the presence of mind, and his family had sufficient financial resources to hire competent legal representation. Ben Hobbs was already in custody in Nevada at the time this investigation began. He was sent to Idaho Falls for interrogation, and he also had the presence of mind to point out in interrogation sessions with Jared Furman that he was aware that there had been genetic testing done, and he was serenely confident that the DNA evidence would show that he was not involved in that crime. So what happened is that Christopher Tapp was the last one left standing when the music stopped and he didn't have a chair. Polygraph examiner Stephen Finn, since retired, as has Jared Furman, systematically lied to Christopher Tapp, convincing him that this piece of highly dubious machinery, which, as I have said before, I consider to be roughly as scientifically valid as water witching, somehow gave an accurate reading into Tapp's subconscious. He persuaded this 20-year-old man, a high school dropout, that rather than merely registering a couple of biometric indicators, blood pressure, galvanic skin response, that somehow the polygraph represented an objective record of what had happened, and that it was the duty of the person being interrogated to conform his answers to what Finn was telling him was the truth. At the same time, Finn and Detective Brown and Jared Furman convinced Tapp that once there were no suspects left, the only way he could avoid execution was to admit that he was involved in some way in the grotesque sexual assault and murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge. Only by admitting to this limited role could he save his own life. Following a May 1998 trial that was replete with perjured testimony by Furman and conscious dishonesty by John Schinderling, who was the associate prosecutor who handled the case, Tapp was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. At the time this happened, Carol Dodge, the mother of the victim, believed firmly that Tapp was guilty. Several years later, not satisfied by a couple of things in the trial that struck her as implausible, she requested and was given access to the hours and hours of videotaped interrogation of Christopher Tapp, and she became convinced that he had been unjustly convicted, and she has since emerged as the single most passionate advocate for Tapp's exoneration. The legal advocacy group Judges for Justice, which consists of retired judges, FBI investigators, legal specialists of various kinds, is prepared to present a detailed and overwhelming case for Tapp's innocence at the April 25th hearings in Idaho Falls. In doing so, they will place before the court and before the public an equally voluminous case for decades of criminal misconduct and institutional corruption on the part of Jared Furman, Kip Manwaring, who had been the prosecutor at the time, John Schinderling, who went on to become a district court judge here in Idaho, the Idaho Falls Police Department, the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, the Municipal Government of Idaho Falls, the so-called criminal justice system of the state of Idaho. Tapp has been relocated from the Idaho prison facility in Cuna to Idaho Falls in anticipation of next month's hearing, which means that Danny Clark, the prosecutor of Bonneville County, and his minions now have more than a month to manipulate him into a plea bargain, which would be a bookend to complement the process through which he was seduced into a false confession in January of 1997. 20 years ago, Furman and his comrades wanted to close a murder case to avoid an institutional embarrassment, and now they want to wring the last full measure of usefulness from their victim by having him accept a deal that will protect them at the cost of his exoneration. Judge Michael Heavey, who was the founder and leader of Judges for Justice, wrote a letter to Tapp on March 7th, begging him not to take the deal which is being offered, which would consist of an Alford plea. He would assert his innocence while admitting that the prosecutor could prove his guilt in court. That would allow Tapp to be sentenced to the time he has already served, perhaps enhanced by a brief term of probation. If you accept an Alford deal, then you spend 20-plus years in prison for nothing, wrote Judge Heavey to Christopher Tapp. Furman wins. Manwaring wins. Schinderling wins. Finn wins. Chris Tapp loses 20 years. Anything short of complete exoneration is a big loss for you, Heavey explained to Chris. The prosecutor's office has done everything they can to keep you in prison for the rest of your life. They are not honorable people. They have the leverage. For about 1 month, don't give in. You are an innocent man. This is one of three cases I have written about and covered extensively on this podcast. I've mentioned the equally bizarre, bogus double murder conviction of Lanny Smith and the incomprehensible rape conviction of Michael Whiteley. Those three cases demonstrate the deeply dysfunctional nature of Bonneville County's criminal justice system. This one, however, the Tapp case, poses the most acute risk to the county's political class. It has received national publicity. The victim is still a young man. He has influential advocates, including the murder victim's mother, and his exoneration would lead to a civil rights suit that he would easily win. Danny Clark and the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office are frantic to get Tapp to accept a deal, any deal that will preserve the pretense that justice was done to some extent in 1997 and 1998. In the fashion of the Inquisitor presiding over the torture of William Wallace at the end of the film Braveheart, Clark and his colleagues, who are conservative and pious people, are urging their victim to acknowledge their divine authority as a condition of being released from his agony. I've only spoken briefly to Danny Clark on one occasion. At the time, his arm was in a sling, and I asked him if he had injured himself while he was wrestling with his conscience and winning. Mr. Clark, you consider yourself to be a godly man, but hell is filled to the brim with godly men like you. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this. An Idaho Falls man who won an appeal claiming a mistrial when he was convicted of molesting three girls was retried this week and convicted once again Thursday, reported the March 10th Idaho Falls Post-Register newspaper. Jeffrey Dunn, 56, originally was convicted by a jury in November 2013 of molesting three girls over several years. One of the girls was 6 years old when the abuse started. District Judge Dane Watkins sentenced Dunn to three life imprisonment terms in February 2014. The first jury was able to hear about Dunn's previous sex crime, a 1990s conviction involving similar conduct and a similarly aged victim. The Idaho Supreme Court of Appeals ruled in March 2016 that the district court erred in allowing the original jury to hear about Dunn's previous crime. I hasten to specify that I'm taking no position as to the guilt or innocence of Mr. Dunn. I'm reading the story in order to make a point that should become clear anon. So Dunn was tried again, continues the Post-Register story, in a three-day trial that began Tuesday. The jury convicted him on three counts of lewd conduct with a child younger than 16 after deliberating for about 2.5 hours Thursday. There was scant physical evidence of the crime, no DNA or photos. So as with the previous trial, the victims each had to testify in front of their abuser. Bonneville County Prosecutor Danny Clark, who led the first trial, said it was just as painful for the victims to testify a second time. This was excruciatingly difficult for the victims to go through again, Clark said. They stayed strong throughout these proceedings, and I'm very pleased with the result. The victims, now between the ages of 18 and 19, had to relive in detail what they had told 12 other strangers in November 2013. Clark said much of the testimony was the same as the previous trial, with the only addition coming from expert witness Tom Tuller. Tuller is a local therapist who specializes in counseling victims of sex crimes. Tuller testified to the nature of sex offenders using grooming techniques to lure victims into trusting their abusers. I want Tom Tuller to analyze Jared Furman. Jared Furman did not sexually exploit Christopher Tapp, nor did Steve Finn. They didn't sexually molest this man, and he wasn't a child at the time of his victimization. Jared Furman, however, did talent scout him as a junior high school-aged child. He became acquainted with Christopher Tapp when he was a school resource officer and DARE instructor at the junior high school that was attended by Christopher Tapp before he dropped out of school. He knew his vulnerabilities, he knew how to manipulate him, and he used precisely the same techniques of psychological coercion, milieu control, insinuating himself into the confidence of his victim that are employed by predators who have sexual interest in vulnerable victims. Furman used those techniques in order to exploit and injure Christopher Tapp. Furman is now apparently beyond personal accountability because he professes to be suffering from a form of early onset Alzheimer's that first began to express himself at about the same time that Christopher Tapp's appeal started to find traction. it would be very instructive, I believe, if Tom Tueller were to run a psychological profile of the predator by the name of Jared Furman. Yesterday, March 9th, Judge Mike Heavey, the retired judge who is the leader and organizer of Judges for Justice, wrote a second letter to Christopher Tapp. Chris, I apologize if my letter of March 7th, 2017 was a bit alarming. Actually, it's all good. A couple of years ago, you would have given almost anything to have been brought from prison by the prosecutor to engage in discussions about how and when you might be released. The below are some suggestions and information that may be useful to you. 1. Invite God in. Ask him to guide you in all decisions that you make. 2. The prosecutor's threats to keep you in prison if Judge Stevens rules in your behalf are all bluster, empty, and not true. I spoke today with Judge Heavey. I asked him to explain what threats have been made. Clark has told Christopher Tapp that if Bonneville County loses on April 25th, as they will, unless they can somehow inveigle Chris into making a plea bargain agreement, that they will file an immediate appeal and he will remain in prison for another 7 years, and that, of course, is a conscious lie. Denny Clark is a prosecutor. Prosecutors lie all the time about everything. Under Idaho law, the only remedy that the judge can impose is a vacation of your conviction, explains Judge Heavey. Under Idaho law, the judge is required to vacate your convictions if he finds that the new evidence of the polygraph videos will probably produce an acquittal. The polygraph videos speak for themselves. No reasonable person could believe anything else other than you are coerced into confessing. It is my considered opinion that Judge Stevens will vacate your conviction. At this point, your May 1998 trial and conviction are rendered a nullity. They essentially never happened. You were not convicted. However, you are still left with the 1997 charges against you, and you are entitled to a jury trial. As you await your new trial, you are entitled to a bail hearing. You are presumed again to be innocent, and you are entitled to reasonable bail. I expect that the judge will release you on your personal recognizance. If the prosecutor wants to appeal Judge Stevens' decision, you will be out on bail. However, listen to John Thomas on this. John Thomas is the appellate attorney for Bonneville County. He's a very good man, in my opinion. He knows more than I do, continues Judge Heavey, but I believe holding you in prison while they appeal the judge's decision is not going to happen. The city of Idaho Falls and the prosecutor for Bonneville County are about to gain a reputation for intentional police misconduct, injustice, and an inability to recognize correct the injustice. NBC with Keith Morrison, CBS's 48 Hours, and Stars, etc., are all doing shows on your case. Intentionally coercing an innocent man into confessing, all on video, will anger good citizens across Idaho and the nation. The good people and businesses of Idaho Falls will all take the hits, while the cops who perpetrated this injustice escape with impunity. Chris, if they are not already involved, I would expect the city of Idaho Falls to be involved with your plea negotiations. They have their good reputations at risk. Jared Furman was elected mayor of Idaho Falls after his police career, and then he stopped in the middle of his term at about the same time once again that Chris Tapp's appeals began to find traction. The advertised reason for doing so was that he had developed an incapacitating short-term memory condition that now was supposedly a form of early-onset Alzheimer's. Notwithstanding this debility, about a year ago, Jared Furman bracketed Carol Dodge in a McDonald's in Idaho Falls and upbraided her at length and in detail and with some asperity about the fact that she had been sowing doubts about what had been done back in 1997 and 1998. And in that conversation, as it was described to me by Carol Dodge, Jared Furman displayed a rather comprehensive grasp of details that he supposedly had forgotten as his neurological disorder takes hold. There is a new mayor in Idaho Falls. As it happens, she's a single mother, a divorced professional woman, who's perhaps politically of a different inclination than the administration before her. She is focusing on the idea of making Idaho Falls attractive as a place to invest and to do business. This is precisely the last kind of thing that she wants to see happen, as she's trying to attract professional-grade businesses to Idaho Falls to refurbish its sagging economy. The city of Idaho Falls and possibly Bonneville County have some serious financial exposure if your conviction is vacated, explains Judge Heavey. And that's one of the reasons, once again, why Prosecutor Danny Clark is frantic to use Christopher Tapp as a scapegoat once again. I'll return shortly.
Troops were successful in spite of your refusal to help me. You might have saved yourself a great deal of torment by yielding at the beginning.
I want to see a neutral representative.
There is no such person. The word will be that you perished with your crew. No one will ever know that you are here with us, as you will be for a long, long time. You do, however, have a choice. You can live out your life in misery, held here, subject to my whims. Or you can live in comfort with good food and warm clothing, women as you desire them, allowed to pursue your studies of philosophy and history. I would enjoy debating with you. You have a keen mind. It's up to you. A life of ease, of reflection, and intellectual challenge. Or this.
In his letter to Christopher Tapp, imploring Tapp not to sign a plea agreement with the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office as a condition of being released from prison prior to the April 25th hearings at which his innocence will be established, Judge Mike Heavey of Judges for Justice takes note of an episode involving Jared Furman, the lead investigator into the 1996 murder of Angie Dodge, for which Christopher Tapp was wrongfully imprisoned, an episode that occurred on January 29th of 1997, following a lengthy series of interrogations that were tantamount to psychological torture of this 20-year-old man who was desperately afraid and was constantly being told that he had to admit to something in order to save his own life. During this January 29th, 1997 interrogation, Furman said something that resonates with the type of tactics that have been used by predators in clerical garb sexually to exploit children and even adults. In itemizing the various parties and interests who are frantically concerned about their liability if Christopher Tapp proceeds with his appeals and is exonerated, Judge Heavey writes the following. To a much lesser extent, the Mormon Church's reputation has some exposure. In the January 29, 1997 interrogation, Jared Furman points at his tie tack, that is to say, the decorative tie pin that he was wearing, and asks you to look at it. It is a small angel, the Angel Moroni tie tack. You say, "It's a little angel." Furman responds, "That's right, Chris. You can look at me like your guardian angel. Your last chance." Later, Furman tells you he is a bishop in the LDS Church, responsible and the leader for 530 members of his ward. Christopher Tapp is not a member of the LDS Church, not a Mormon. He was raised as a Baptist. At least that's what his mother told me when I interviewed her. But the point here is that Furman is seeking to elicit Christopher Tapp's trust and confidence on the basis of his position as the equivalent of a parish priest in the Catholic Church or a pastor in an evangelical faith congregation. A bishop is a judge in Israel from the perspective of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they take confessions, and they are looked upon as advocates for the sinners over whom they have ecclesial jurisdiction. Furman is deploying the skill set of a cleric in order to seduce a man into confessing to a crime he didn't commit. Although you may be threatened otherwise, continued Judge Heavey in his letter to Christopher Tapp, I expect proposed deals to keep coming at you until the day before Judge Stevens rules. Do not hurry, do not be bullied. You let Furman bully you 20 years ago. Don't let it happen again. I was a little harsh with the prosecutors in my previous letter, writes Judge Heavey, who was being excessively generous. No, in describing them as dishonorable people, he was being careful and accurate in his assessment of what passes for their character. I am hoping, he continues, they will rise to the occasion, do justice, and truly represent all the good citizens of Bonneville County, not just a few misguided cops. These police officers were not misguided. Shortly, I will share with you some excerpts from a fascinating and perfectly infuriating book, which seems to be the only variety I read most of the time, entitled How the Police Generate False Confessions, An Inside Look at the Interrogation Room, by former Washington, D.C. homicide investigator James L. Tranum. And in these excerpts, it becomes clear that the methods employed to manipulate Christopher Tapp into a false confession that has stolen 20 years of his life are standard procedure in nearly every significant police department across the length and breadth of the American Soyuz. These are not misguided cops. These are not exceptionally depraved police officers. These are representative police officers. What's exceptional about this case, to the extent that it can be considered exceptional, given that there are wrongful convictions of this sort by the hundreds or thousands that one can document. What might be exceptional here is this nexus between the professional impunity of police officers, and especially prosecutors, and the authoritarian nature of the culture of southeastern Idaho. That's something I explained to Judge Heavey this afternoon when I spoke with him about the letters that he had written to Christopher Tapp. A very bright attorney of my acquaintance in Utah, this is a point I might have made on a couple of previous occasions, has been driven to distraction and nearly to drinking, like myself, he's a teetotaler, because of the complacent nature of the people he represents as a criminal defense attorney. This is a very bright man who studied abroad. He's one of the few people of his vintage, he's roughly my age, he's in his early 50s, who had the opportunity to study law behind the Iron Curtain before it fell in 1989. This man is a very devout member of the LDS Church, a lifelong Mormon. But what he said is that the culture of Utah Mormonism, which I contend is broadly congruent to the culture of southeastern Idaho Mormonism, represents the most culturally communistic population in the English-speaking world because of their attitudes about deference to established authority and the need to be part of an homogeneous community when it comes to submitting to authority. And because the people these defendants deal with as police investigators and prosecutors and judges are all drawn from the same socio-religious cohort, they cannot see them as adversaries. They cannot understand that when police come to your doorstep, or when they are interrogating you at the station house, or when you're dealing with a prosecutor, they do not have your best interests in mind or at heart. In this January 29, 1997 interrogation, although Christopher Tapp was not a Mormon, Jared Furman was using these implicit appeals to authority in order to break down his resistance and to make him accede to the demand that he confess to a crime he didn't commit. These are not misguided cops. These are police officers who are using the standard tools of their trade, reinforced by the attitudes of the most conformist community in the English-speaking world. At the December 13, 2016 hearing, Judge Stevens opined that if there is a lack of your DNA at the crime scene, he will look closely at the videos to see if you were interrogated during the polygraph examinations, continues Judge Heavey. He will see that the police used the polygraph as a ruse, a sham. It was not used to assess credibility. He will not only see that you were interrogated, but also that you were coerced, tricked, manipulated, and brainwashed during the polygraph exams. Once again, Stephen Finn had convinced Christopher Tapp, a very credulous young man, that the polygraph somehow had access to the objective truth of what had happened, and that it was the duty of Chris Tapp to conform his answers to what he was being fed by Stephen Finn and by Jared Furman. I suggest you allow me to advise you during these negotiations, and also that you bring in another lawyer that can assess the criminal and civil issues that are involved, recommended Judge Heavey. The Book of Proverbs advises that with many counselors comes wise decisions. There is nothing that cannot be discussed in the light. Do not let these matters be hidden in darkness. You hold all the aces. Shalom, amigo, and peace, Judge Michael Heavey. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
What must I do?
Nothing, really. Tell me, how many lights you see? How many? This is your last chance. The guards are coming. Don't be a stubborn fool.
How many?
You told me he would be ready to go.
We had some unfinished business.
Get him cleaned up. Captain Picard. If you'll go with the guards, they'll take care of you.
It's a phenomenon that remains understandably incomprehensible to many, writes Tom Jackman of the Washington Post, reviewing John Tranum's book, How the Police Generate False Confessions. Someone admits to a crime they did not actually commit, to a police detective of all people, knowing they face a long prison sentence for doing so. Who would do such a thing? In all three of the cases mentioned previously, in the paragraph just preceding this one, young men admitted to committing rape, and in two of them to gruesome murders. Tranum, 61, spent 17 years in homicide for the Metropolitan Police Department, retiring in 2010. He was the lead detective on the high-profile Starbucks triple murder in Georgetown in 1997, which he eventually helped solve in 1999. But in 1994, Tranum had an eye-opening experience when he obtained his own false confession. After a 16-hour interrogation, a woman told him she and two men had killed a man whose body was found, bound, and beaten near the Anacostia River. She was charged with first-degree murder, but she recanted weeks later, and Tranum found proof that she couldn't have been where she originally claimed at the time of the slaying. The charges were dismissed. "What did I do?" Tranum asked himself. "To convince this person to tell me something she didn't do. How did she get all those details she shouldn't have known?" He realized that implying that her cooperation would get her better treatment from the prosecutors and minimizing her role in the case to obtain her testimony against co-defendants, as well as a mistaken handwriting analysis and a bogus voice stress test, got her to confess. What's remarkable here is that John Tranum had done exactly the same thing to this hapless woman that Jared Furman and Steve Finn did to Christopher Tapp. But John Tranum had the character and the decency to realize that what he had done was wrong, and the moral courage to correct it. Those qualities are utterly absent from Jared Furman and Stephen Finn. Tranum began researching the concept of false confessions, not widely discussed in the 1990s, At that time, five New York teenagers were in prison for allegedly raping a woman in Central Park in 1989. Though DNA later proved an unrelated man had committed the crime, some people still believe the Central Park Five are guilty, including presidential candidate, now President Donald Trump. It just shows you what the power of a confession is, Trainum said. In spite of the overwhelming evidence, physical and otherwise, people still believe a confession trumps everything, no pun intended. False confessions are now understood to be a significant contribution to wrongful convictions, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. Of 1,900 wrongful convictions in their database, 234 were caused by false confessions, or about 12%. Trainum said detectives are just following their training, which is often minimal, which allows for not only unethical tactics but lying by investigators, who can falsely tell a suspect they failed a polygraph, that's something that Steve Finn did on several occasions to Christopher Tapp, that other people identified him as a suspect, and that evidence indicates he committed the crime. Trainum summarizes the approach that most detectives take to a suspect in the box. 1. Conclude that the suspect is guilty. 2. Tell them there is no doubt of their guilt. 3. Block any attempt by the suspect to deny the accusation. 4. Suggest psychological or moral justifications for what they did. 5. Lie about the strength of the evidence that points to the suspect's guilt. 6. Offer only two explanations for why he committed the crime. Both are admissions, but one is definitely less savory than the other. 7. Get them to agree with you that they did it. 8. Have them provide details about the crime. Turning now to Trainum's book, which was published last year amid a great outpouring of indignant outrage from his erstwhile professional associates, we read the following. Many times law enforcement and prosecutors will go to great lengths to defend the original confession, asserting that in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, it still must be true. Such reasoning gymnastics have led to some pretty amazing theories, especially when the confession is proven to be false, when the DNA from semen recovered from the victim does not match the confessor. The prosecutor and/or police will switch their original theory of a single perpetrator to multiple perpetrators, even when the DNA is matched to someone that can be found to have no connection to the confessor. Some of the more outrageous theories I have heard include the DNA came from a mysterious person who found the body afterward and had sex with a corpse, it somehow drifted downriver and landed on a body that was discovered in water, or the crime scene was located in a lover's lane and the DNA got on the victim's body when they rubbed up against what must have been a semen-coated tree. This is the sort of thing that happens when wish replaces thought, as it consistently does when you're dealing with false confessions and people who are desperate to protect them. Through the interrogation process, the person comes to believe that they committed a crime or had knowledge of or witnessed something, even though they have no actual memory of having done so. That's something that was captured on many occasions during the psychological torture come investigation of Christopher Tapp. In a case referred to by John Trainum, one of the investigators suggested that a wrongfully convicted man by the name of Joe Dick might have blacked out. That's something that was said on numerous occasions by Stephen Finn to Christopher Tapp, and by Jared Furman as well. What happens is that the suspect or witness begins to distrust their memory and begins to look to the investigator for suggestions or answers. Once again, in the videotaped confessions or interrogations of Christopher Tapp, there are numerous occasions when he imploringly looks at Furman or at Furman's associates, hoping that they will feed him the correct answer so he can give it back to them in the hope that he will avoid being executed. By the time they give their final confession, the suspect or witness actually believes what they said is true. This condition might last, or it may dissipate once the suspect or witness leaves the interrogation room and is no longer subjected to its coercive influence. The internalized classification of confession is usually associated with false confessions and statements. In the interrogation room, the suspect who respects and trusts law enforcement, I underscore once again the fact that Jared Furman had been grooming Christopher Tapp since he was in junior high school, and authority in general. Look at my Angel Moroni pin, Chris. I'm a bishop in the Mormon Church. I'm your guardian angel. I'm the only one who can trust. I'm your last chance. seems to be more susceptible to making a coerced, internalized confession. The investigator, an authority figure many have grown up being told to trust, tells the suspect that there is no doubt that they committed the crime, and all of the evidence points to their guilt. The investigator is absolutely confident and will not let the suspect get a word in edgewise. The suspect believes, and is often told by the investigator, that it is against the law for the investigator to lie, so all of this must be true. Doubt begins to enter the suspect's mind. The investigator asks if the suspect has a drinking problem. Maybe they were on drugs. Maybe the crime was so horrific that the suspect has tried to push it from their mind. There is no way that anyone would forget something like that. A little bit further on in Trainum's book, we read about the abuse of the polygraph. The most commonly used scientific evidence is the polygraph, the accuracy of which is questionable, as discussed earlier in the book. The polygraph examiner, who usually works for the law enforcement agency conducting the investigation, in Christopher Tapp's case it was a detective with the IFPD, first sells the polygraph machine to the suspect as scientifically proven and impossible to fool. Aside from the questionable validity of the polygraph itself, there is no requirement that the investigator or the polygraph examiner tell the suspect the true test results. That's what Finn did. He systematically and deliberately lied when Christopher Tapp, according to the biometric indications registered on the polygraph, was answering truthfully about his complete lack of involvement in the crime. Finn lied to him and then reinforced inaccurate readings that showed that he was being deceptive when he was reciting back to the police the stories that he was being fed in order to inculpate him. The Christopher Tapp wrongful conviction is a textbook wrongful conviction. Jared Furman, Stephen Finn, Detective Ken Brown, former Bonneville County Prosecutor Kip Manwaring, and Assistant Prosecutor John Schinderling. These are males. I won't give them the dignity of calling them men who have the ethics of a child molester. Lex Talanis, as I've pointed out before, dictates that someone who falsely accuses somebody of a crime has to serve the same sentence or suffer the same penalty that would be inflicted upon their innocent victim. Incumbent Bonneville County Prosecutor Danny Clark is implicating himself in that crime by seeking to induce Christopher Tapp into taking a guilty plea, knowing now to the point of a moral certainty that Christopher Tapp is an innocent man. If Danny Clark were any part of a man, he would move to vacate the conviction, and he would file charges against Furman, Finn, Manwaring, Schinderling, and Brown. Those of you who are inclined to do so, please pray on behalf of Christopher Tapp. Pray that he will have strength to withstand this last full measure of malice at the hands of his captors and tormentors. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at the Libertarian Institute, that's libertarianinstitute.org, and at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.